Seeing the Goldsmith's Face, commentary for the July 23, 2022 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. And we all, who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory, are being transformed into His image with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, who is the Spirit. 2 Corinthians 3:18. Our lesson quarterly opens with a story about a gold refiner that is attributed to Amy Carmichael by Stuart and Brenda Blanche. Stuart was an Anglican prelate who wrote the foreword to the book, which was put together by his wife Brenda. Stuart had suffered a breakdown prior to this book being published, and never fully recovered before his death a few years later. He entered the ministry near the time of Amy Carmichael's death and probably did not know her personally. There is no indication his wife Brenda had any relationship with Ms. Carmichael either. In view of this, it is strange that the lesson author went to such lengths to document the source of the refiner's fire story. While Brenda Blanche added more details, such as the tamarind, the salt, and the tile, the story has been around for a very long time in various forms. And if Amy Carmichael related the story at all to school children, as implied in the book Learning of God, she was probably only repeating the story as a parable that had been long in circulation as an apt illustration. No one really knows who first related the parable and to whom. It illustrates not only its intended lesson well, but it also shows how what is meant to simply be a metaphor is also instructive for Christian living. The person seeking the answer from the refiner is sometimes a woman, a young man, school children, or whatever suitable seeker relates best to the intended audience. For those who do not have access to the quarterly, I will share a similar parable here. Some time ago, a few ladies met in a certain city to read the scriptures and made them the subject of conversation. While reading the third chapter of Malachi, they came upon a remarkable expression in the third verse, "And he shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver." One lady's opinion was that this was intended to convey the view of the sanctifying influence of the grace of Christ. Then she proposed to visit a silversmith and report to them what he said on the subject. She went accordingly, and without telling the object of her errand, begged to know the process of refining silver, which he fully described to her. "But, sir," she said, "do you sit while the work of refining is going on?" "Oh, yes, madam," replied the silversmith. "I must sit with my eyes steadily fixed on the furnace, for if the time necessary for refining be exceeded in the slightest degree, the silver will be injured." The lady at once saw the beauty and comfort, too, of the expression, "He shall sit as a refiner and purifier of silver." Christ sees it needful to put his children into a furnace. His eye is steadily intent on the work of purifying, and his wisdom and love are both engaged in the best manner for them. Their trials do not come at random. The very hairs of your head are all numbered. As the lady was leaving the shop, the silversmith called her back and said he had forgot to mention that the only way that he knows when the process of purifying is complete is when he sees his own image reflected in the silver. This story has been on our Stillwaters Ministry website almost as long as it has been since Living for God was published, and I acquired it from a much older anthology that listed the source as anonymous. It continues to be widely available on the internet through a simple Google search. The value in these metaphors is not in whether the incident is true, but in the validity of their message. Refining produces the image sought by the refiner, and if God is refining us, it is only to see his image in us. Like the parables of Christ, it is a simple story with a profound message. It encourages us to look in the mirror at ourselves and ask what we see reflected there. In our time, there are so many different and diametrically opposed definitions of what it means to be a Christian, that it becomes apparent that we are not looking in the same mirror. Or, like James said, anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. James 1, verses 23 and 24. That we are not looking at the same mirror is apparent when some model an image of God that wants to stone sinners to death for any of the capital infractions listed in the Old Testament. The image reflected in their mirror is one of harshness, punishment, and weeding sinners out before they taint the rest of the fruit in the barrel. These may be personified by Puritans, strict Calvinists who settled in what is now Massachusetts. They outlawed anything that deviated from a stern, somber religious experience, even executing those who would deviate from that path. Quakers were among those so treated. Puritan faith was based on being good enough to be saved, while always being one step from falling away. The Quakers took a far more personal approach to faith, with roots in Arminianism and Pelagianism. As one might expect, with a more individual, less corporate theological lens with which to view the world, Quaker fellowships tended to fracture based on personal inspiration, producing several different societies since the 17th century. They often, though not always, leaned toward more progressive understandings, such as pacifism and leadership that was not gender exclusive. Eager to share their progressive views with their Calvinist neighbors in Boston resulted in imprisonment, banishment, and even execution, as in the case of Mary Dyer in 1660. The persecution of Quakers by the Puritans got to such a point that the British Crown had to intervene, revoking the Massachusetts Charter and sending a governor for direct rule. The 1689 Toleration Act gave the governor further power to prevent religious persecution. Despite the lessons from this sad period of our nation's founding, we seem not to have learned from it, for two versions of Christianity have continued to strive for supremacy in the United States. Some churches found that the conflict existed within the same denomination. For instance, in a split over the issue of the enslavement of black people, those who saw it as unbiblical formed the American Baptist Church, and those who felt the Bible supported the idea of enslavement formed the Southern Baptist Church. The split ran not only through denominations, but through families. When the Civil War broke out, members of the same family would find themselves fighting on opposite sides in the conflict. Though hundreds of thousands lost their lives in that conflagration, there are those few who continue today to argue for the supremacy of the white race over all others and use Christian terminology and imagery to advance that agenda. Those fault lines have only deepened and widened as other issues have been added to the brewing cauldron. Abortion, guns, gender diversity, sexism, headship theology, and biblical inerrancy have fomented a poisonous goulash that each side tries to force the other to eat. The same Bible that teaches that we are to love our enemies in the Sermon on the Mount is also used to condemn, ostracize, and defame those same enemies with proof texting from other places in the Bible. It is as though we are believing that the Bible is literal when it is talking about stoning, but not when it is talking about loving. We each make a theological salad of the ingredients we like best, and we like to go around telling others how our salad tastes so much better than theirs. When we are offered a taste of theirs, we demur. Why would we taste theirs when we already know ours is the best because it is filled with what we like? We may even spend hours on social media telling others why our salad is best, and that those others are not worth the time to taste. Maybe that attitude is why Christianity, the Christianity our salad represents, is so unappealing to others. We should understand that when we investigate the melted metal that is in the refiner's fire, when the metal is purified, the only image that will be staring back at us is our own. No matter how much purity the metal has, it will still reflect every one of our impurities. It cannot help us to be other than what we are. Only God can do that, and like the refiner patiently works the metal ore, God will patiently work with us over our lifetimes to an end that will be more than we would have expected at the beginning of our spiritual journey. As one author puts it, if received in faith, the trial that seems so bitter and hard to bear will prove a blessing. The cruel blow that blights the joys of earth will be the means of turning our eyes to heaven. How many there are who would never have known Jesus had not sorrow led them to seek comfort in him. The trials of life are God's workmen to remove the impurities and roughness from our character. Their hewing, squaring, chiseling, their burnishing and polishing is a painful process. It is hard to be pressed down to the grinding wheel. But the stone is brought forth, prepared to fill its place in the heavenly temple. Upon no useless material does the Master bestow such careful, thorough work. Only his precious stones are polished after the similitude of a palace. Thoughts from the Mount of Blessings, page 10. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find the written version of this podcast, as well as hundreds more versions in writing, at our website at www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.